We're here to talk about the future, some of the things that we might expect between now and the end of this century. We've invited three people who've studied it, written about it, and who will bring to the subject three distinct and different perspectives. Anthropologist Margaret Meads, renowned for her pioneering work in oceanic cultures. She's curator emeritus of ethnology at the American Museum of Natural History, chairperson of the Council of New Directions, and writes in a wide range of publications on sociology, psychology, culture, and race relations. Dr. Meads' books include Coming of Age in Samoa, Culture and Commitment, A Study in the Generation Gap, and World Enough, Rethinking the Future. Herman Kahn is director of the Hudson Institute, a futurological think tank. He is a physicist, a former military analyst with the RAND Corporation. He's written major works on nuclear strategy and is defense and policy advisor to governments and industry. Dr. Kahn's books include On Thermonuclear War, The Year 2000, and The Next 200 Years. William Irwin Thompson is a historian. He's founder and chairman of the Lindisfarne Institute in New York, an independent community of scholars, bringing together scientists, philosophers, and artists to study the emerging planetary culture. Dr. Thompson's books include At the Edge of History, Passages About Earth, and Darkness and Scattered Light, four talks on the future. Dr. Meads, it seems that a lot of problems in the world today stem from the growing tension between the different cultures, the different races, the sexes, and the generations. And you've studied this as a woman, as a mother, as a grandmother, and as an anthropologist. Do you think that we'll be any nearer to solving any of these problems by the end of the century than we are now?
Well, you see, I think these problems are simply an example of the change in the structure of society, that at present we have a very rapidly changing society, and as it's been said, the rate of change equals the rate of transportation. So now we're dealing with the Concorde, and such changes put tremendous stress on relations between one generation and another, between the sexes, between the races, between people of different religious groups. But I think the most important thing is not to concentrate on that sort of thing, but concentrate on the fact that what the future is like, it depends on us now, that we are building the future now. If we build it in too rosy terms, people will not take the necessary precautions they should take to see it gets here. And if we build it in too doomsday terms, again, people will become apathetic and not do the things that need to be done. And we have to realize that everything we say about the future is going to influence the future, and that the picture we draw of the future is therefore tremendously important. The people that are going to be in charge in the year 2000 are born now. We're not talking about the unconceived. We're talking about people who are being subjected to today's strains, to today's prophecies, and who will or will not be able to shepherd the sheep on this planet to a safer pasture than we look as if we were going towards now.
Well, Dr. Kahn, you've been saying recently that the world is entering something of a golden age, a new Belle Epoque, as you've called it, in which all of the major problems are going to be solved, in which the rich will get richer, in which the poor will also get richer. And generally, you seem to have taken a much more optimistic view of the future than most futurologists. So how do you see us solving some of the problems that seem so threatening today? Energy crises, unemployment, pollution, food supply, population, these kinds of things.
Well, most of these problems, in some sense, solve themselves. You know, by solve, I mean you live with them. I'm really not an optimist as painted. I do think that barring very bad luck or very bad management, you'll have enormous economic progress. What I mean by economic progress, you get a lot richer. Now, people deny that being richer is better, and I'm not completely unsympathetic to that point of view. Basically, what we have done in our most recent studies is try to say that the doomsday picture that you have described are just wrong, in the sense that they have not been proved, to put it mildly, and in the second sense that they're probably very unlikely. Now, in terms of, we actually are a little bit pessimistic about the world. We tend to be a little Augustinian, and we worry lots about problems of self-discipline, problems of structure. The biggest change in the world is the affluence. People are just incredibly rich by any standard, up until except the standards of today. You know, I mean, in other words, The second big change, of course, the access to two technology. The usual description of the world is as an island of wealth surrounded by a sea of misery is itself just dead wrong. 25% of the world lives in countries which are rich by almost any standards. About 45% of the world lives in countries called middle income. They're rich by historical standards, poor by today's standards, you know, so they're middle income. And about 30% of the world lives in genuinely poor countries, traditional levels of poverty. You know, by the end of the century, the year 2000, even these countries are likely to be around, let's say, $300 per capita, which would be like the Roman Empire at its peak, you know, when it was sort of very, very well off.
Well, I wonder how this locks in with what Dr. Thompson's been saying in recent years. You seem to be suggesting that we are on the threshold of something, a profound change in almost the species itself, something like a species change. You talk of the new emerging planetary culture and some of its implications. I wonder how this locks in with the kind of expectations that Dr. Kahn's been talking about. Does this conflict with that?
Well, I think they're quite different, and they're not necessarily in simple agreement. My position is probably closer to Dr. Mead's. I think we're undergoing a dramatic shift in symbolic systems, and that part of the disorientation that you're describing is that there is a planetary envelope of symbols, much like Christendom was in the Middle Ages, and that doesn't have much to do with urbanization and nation states, which is the structure of industrial society. And so people are looking for smaller regional definitions of identity, whether it's being in Ulster or in Quebec or the Basque or the Serbs, and that nationalism and the romantic nationalism, which was related to industrial society, is on its way out. So there, when you can look at the Earth on the television, then it changes your whole kind of relationship to what your identity is and who you are and where you're going and what it's all about. So I think the change is like the shift from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance and the emergence of the modern world. It's a very, very large shift, and it's changing the whole symbolic envelopment of what constitutes individual identity for the person. I disagree with Dr. Kahn in the sense that I think he's tending to think in continuations of industrial terms, and I think it's quite true that I don't think it's going to be doomsday, and I think the doomsday prophets are mistaken, and I agree with Dr. Mead that those can become self-fulfilling prophecies. If we believe it, we'll make it come true. That's just an idea as old as Buddhism. But I do think we're in for a period of profound disorientation, and that if you look at the emergence of the modern world, the 17th century was called the century of genius by Whitehead, but it was also the century of the 30 Years' War, and Descartes was a soldier. And so I think in terms of relationships of nature, self, and society, ecology, a crisis of the agribusiness, there are going to be profound shocks coming up ahead. And in order to survive them, we're going to have deeper roots of identity than consumerism, of defining ourselves by our car or our house or the clothes we wear. And I see the only way we're going to make it to the year 2000, when I'll be 62, is by a revolution of consciousness as profound as the great universal religions that have accentuated the development of human culture all through human history.
Do you think this is a romantic view of the future or what?
I think it's partially romantic. Partially wishful thinking, and partially accurate. That is, there is an incredible change going on in the world. Very likely, 1976 saw the peak rate of population growth. Very likely, the next decade, we'll see the peak rate of gross world product growth. And what you've had is a kind of if you look at a 20,000-year graph, kind of a steady line, incredibly sharp spike, and a steady line. And that's a change. I mean, it's a very dramatic change. How much of this change will occur by the end of the century, I would be very dubious. The basic move of the United States is to return to square values. Carter and Ford both ran on very square platforms. This may only last 5 years, may last two decades. Depends on policies. But if this kind of reemergence of square values lasts for two decades, as it could, the year 2000 is going to find a return to the kind of family values.
You see, I think you just keep on talking as if there was nothing in the world except Europe. And we go back to the Middle Ages as a paradigm. We don't look at the world. We don't take into account China and India and Africa. And to keep referring to what's just happened in Europe as if this was the history of the world is one of the things that bogs us down, and bogs us down very badly.
I agree with that, certainly in terms of numbers of people. In terms of kind of leading sectors for the change, I think it's right to look at Western culture for a while. I also tend to have a feeling that when the emphasis on growth stops, as I think will happen within, say, 25 years, then you're going to have a kind of return to pre-industrial religions, pre-industrial attitudes, pre-industrial concepts. And these are really pre-industrial things you're talking
See,
about.
See, I don't think we're going to Not return to anything. You can't return to things. If we have a religion and a religious life that's different from what we have now, it won't be pre-industrial, it'll be post-industrial.
It'll be post-industrial, I agree. But the more we look at this post-industrial thing, and we've been looking at it now for 5-6 years, I'm not saying well, I have no sense to have a good feel for it, everything looks more and more pre-industrial. and it didn't start out that way. We didn't say, you're going to go back to these kind of small communities, you're going to go back to kind of Buddhism type things in some situations. We really thought of the post-industrial world as different.
Yes, that's right.
And we kept trying to look at these differences, and we have a kind of an urge for consistency, which is the mark of small minds, we all know, but that's what we're interested in.
But see, the danger with the pre-industrial way of thinking, that you're using this as a label, is it looks at history as a line, where it's more like a growth spiral, that sometimes you
Absolutely
go back to pre-industrial things and reconstitute them. When Buddhism went from India to Tibet to China to Japan, culture changed dramatically with each shift. Now that Buddhism is coming to America, there's a profound cultural influence, and these are the things that change in symbol systems are all made
of. When I say
up,
go back, I definitely don't mean go back. I mean
right,
the spiral,
then don't say it.
The spiral of change. But the thing that startles me, whenever I try to think these things through, is how many elements of what I had associated with pre-industrial cultures turn out to reemerge. Elements, not the package, not the whole,
mm-hmm.
but pieces of it. You know, and one way I think to understand better what's going to happen is to look better, more strongly at the medieval period. We've lost. You know the book by Huizinga, The Decline of the Medieval Period?
Waning of the Middle Ages.
Waning of the Middle Ages, right.
Yeah.
And he starts off that first 4 or 5 pages when he talks about how dramatic everything was, and how sharp and how significant and meaningful and so on. I mean, returning to those kinds of values to the extent that you can fit them into a very different world.
Well, if you add the spiral image that Jeff's putting in here, you see, so that the next time you come around, you're in a different place. But I'm very much afraid about talking about returns. I'm very much afraid of using this contemporary word like square, that we're going to go back to being square, when square is a little American position that characterized a brief period in history. And if we're going to think about the whole world, we've got to stop thinking so ethnocentrically. We've got to stop using European figures of speech that don't mean a lot to most of the people in the world.
No, when I accept completely your point that I was talking only about the United States. I was only talking about a 2-decade period.
Yes.
I don't think there's going to be a mm-hmm. century return to square values. I'm talking about a 1 or 2 decades.
Yes.
But I think it's important. I think it's important to understand that the year 2000 is not that far away,
right.
at least in the United States. Now we are at the moment doing a worldwide study, trying to do exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. The first thing we look at, of course, is the level of affluence. Not because that affluence determines everything, but it does set a context.
But your definition of affluence, I'd love to take you to live in a village somewhere for any real length of time. It isn't affluence if your food comes from the other side of the world, and if something goes wrong, you have no food. It isn't affluence if you everything that you use is made somewhere else and it doesn't suit you, if you have to sit in chairs that you can't sit on. It's affluence if you count the amount of food that comes in sometimes. It's affluence if you look at the chairs and don't notice what it's like to sit on them.
I really disagree with that. At the moment, it's very fashionable to poo-poo, quote, standard living, and to talk about it as a kind of a totally fake and artificial concept. Now, it's quite clear that the concept has all kinds of problems. There's no question about that. And it's even clear that it means different things in different countries. You look at Colombia, $300 per capita. You look at Korea, it's $300 per capita. And so the night and day difference, you know, the way people live, so on. So it has all those problems. Nevertheless, it's a very important concept in orienting a lot of things. It tells you roughly what the resources the community has available. The physical resources, not the...
Everything that we've looked at recently shows that correlating things with a GNP or a per capita income is just not about the things we're really talking about. It doesn't even correlate with whether the population will decline or not properly. I don't think it's a good measure, and I think we ought to look at how people really live.
I wouldn't argue about the second point at all. If you know about the GNP of a country or GDP per capita, you know only one single number.
That's right.
And people are very complicated. And communities are even more complicated.
But if you only look at the things that make affluence in our terms and count them up in our terms, we're not thinking about the way other people live at all.
That, I think, is right, too. But you think a lot about their future. I mean by that, I would be very surprised if 95% of the world's people did not go through some kind of industrialization. You know, in other words, I don't think you're going to have a rejection of the industrialization process anywhere in the world, except like in Burma for a while, which was rejecting it.
No, but I think we're going to have a totally different kind of industrialization with decentralized power, and that'll make a great deal of difference.
I agree with Dr. Mead. I see, one of the things I think we should be very clear about in terms of when, say, you've seen me as romantic and I see you as romantic, is that each of us, in a sense, describes the world from our own autobiographical position. You grew up under the RAND Corporation and are describing the Los Angelization of the planet. I grew up in Los Angeles, so I can understand where you're coming from. I don't agree with it because I think that was the peculiar period of history of rapid, phenomenal, almost carcinogenic growth that became the archetype of glamour for the world, so that Tehran has smog now, Sydney has smog, every city wants highways. The difficulty with trying to apologize for industrialization is that those glamours become dangerous. Now, the Saudi Arabians had a marvelous waste disposal system which just evaporated in the heat and required no water, but because of the glamour of the American model and the affluence model, they bring in flush toilets and they bring in supermarkets and they bring in all the things that are really primitive. If they use their capital in a more imaginative and what Schumacher would call an appropriate technology, that kind of dead-end Los Angeles thing could be avoided. One of the real difficulties I have with your, what I consider linear extrapolations, is they're simply projecting an anomalous period of 1945 to 1973. In your book on the year 2000, which was written in 67, you had nothing to say about the pollution which came in 68, the whole environmental crisis. You didn't talk about the energy crisis. You couldn't even be as far ahead as 1968 or 69.
We did talk about called zoning ordinances. We didn't use the term pollution. We did not catch on that it would be an incredibly romantic thing and overstated by factors of 50. We talked about zoning ordinances, the need to control external products. And that's the pollution as far as I'm concerned. There's just no difference. We didn't take the energy crisis because it's a pure accident.
That's what history's made of, you see.
Absolutely.
It's not planned.
We're not trying to produce history. We're trying to produce those trends which tend to go through despite historical events.
And you can go back and you can do nice little extrapolations and look at the way things were developing in Europe, and then the suburbanization becomes a result of the motor car.
I think that's correct. Suburbanization of the motor car. The motor car depends upon petroleum.
And the motor car...
But it doesn't depend upon Saudi Arabia.
No, of course it doesn't depend on Saudi Arabia. It depends on the existence of and the use that we make of oil.
If we have in this country something like 3 trillion barrels of oil we can get from solid fuels. That'll last us if we wanted to for 500 years.
It'll heat up the atmosphere and change the ecology.
You're not including pollution. How are you going to deal with the deterioration of the central cities?
The basic reason the central cities are deteriorating is all of the old cities are built around streetcars. And when you get in the automobile age, people want a much lower density. You're absolutely correct. It's affecting the automobile.
That's right.
And that means the city has to learn live less expensively. In other words, the adjustment to a lower total income is what the biggest single problem you have in the cities in the United States. And it's not that it's adjustment which is impossible to do, it's just difficult.
But see, it was your kind of thinking that dismantled the Pacific Electric Railway in Los Angeles and shifted them to freeways, or the Robert Moses kind of thing that made the Nassau County structure of New York as a megalopolis possible, where community was willfully destroyed and public transportation that was in existence was dismantled, freeways were built, and now we've got smog, we've got the kind of alienation where people spend an hour driving to work and have to listen to the radio to have some sense of community. We have a whole kind of world. Los Angeles has become the archetype of the way most of the people in L.A. don't want to live, this, we're saying, is the future of the world.
One of the differences of the United States and the rest of the world, but less different than I used to think it was, is that more than any other kind of world, the middle class determines what goes on. Not the upper middle class, not the rich. Now, it's not true in other countries of the world.
Of course, this, again, is a nice little American position.
Yeah, it's pretty
American. Because we have, prevailingly, our biggest class is the middle class. And you go to countries where there's no middle class, and look at South America, which never developed a middle class like ours, and if you predicted its growth in these terms, you could not have predicted the form it's taking now.
Well, you were talking about trends and the trend toward following the lead of the Western world. Is it a trend that by the end of this century, most of the world will be, if not Americanized or Westernized, at least most of the world, most of the third world, will be
industrialized?
I would rather say technologized, you see, because I think we're going to have to use high technology as well as low technology. I don't believe in the people who think we're all going to go back and grow our own beans. We're going to have to grow our beans with the help of the most modern, high-level, computerized technology that exists. And so at present, the trends that are going on, one group of people that are against high technology, the other group of people who know what it can do, and they both talk nonsense, from my point of view. We're going to have to combine them as the new alchemy people do. We're going to have to monitor what you're doing every minute to know how to manage things. But so I think undoubtedly by the year 2000, we'll have a considerable importation of modern technology in the places where it doesn't exist now. I think that is undoubtedly true. But at the same time, I think we have forces making for decentralization, the dangers of nuclear power, where nuclear power means, in effect, more and more state power in order to make it safe, more and more centralization, more and more secret surveillance of everyone. On the other hand, various forms of natural power that can't be exhausted make for decentralization. And I think that I agree with Herman, that there are trends, but there are several trends, not just one trend. And one of the trends, I think, is towards localization, regionalization, which you, to some extent, agree with, too, that we won't be transporting food all over the ocean three or four times, that food will be grown where we live, things will be made where we live, and we'll use our energy for things we need to use our energy for.
Well, I think there's no question with modern technology, you can do a great deal of decentralization. I think in most cases, the decision will be based on economics and not on kind of a style of life. In other words, very narrow economic considerations are still likely to dominate. I mean by narrow.
Economics is a very narrow set of considerations.
I said it's very narrow.
Yeah,
I emphasize
you said that.
Very narrow economic considerations, not the whole style of life or how we want people to live or what kind of person you want to produce. I think to an incredible degree, people like to economize resources in these poor countries. And if this causes changes in family and changes in, so be it, is their attitude. And I am not unsympathetic with them, though the costs are enormous, in disruption, unnecessary disruption.
Well, almost anything we do now, the costs are going to be enormous.
And also the gains are enormous.
Yeah.
And people understand that. As a matter of fact, we started what we called Sideways in Technology back in 1955. And we meant by that neither more modern nor less modern, but just appropriate. And there's no question this terrible nonsense of copying America where it's totally inappropriate. We've killed off half the air forces of the world in the third world by giving them inappropriate high-performance planes. The flush toilet, people will put in flush toilets but they have no water.
That's right.
Just to have it, to sit on it.
Or a telephone when they have no wires.
And one of the great crimes of the industrialized world is never to think in terms of the third world and think what's appropriate. And one of the great crimes of some of the third world, not all, is not to think through their own problems.
That's right.
In other words, they slavishly copy the U.S.
But they were educated either in the U.S. or in Europe. There was an elite that was totally educated in our set of values, and they were all the educated people that were there to take the leadership, and they were ruthlessly exploited commercially by things that would pay. And so I don't think we can blame them. I think we have to, and there's a lot of blame is dished out. But we have to give them the tools to think differently.
Some countries haven't done this. Actually, the most extraordinary examples of thinking through your own problems are in the Chinese culture area.
But not
about mainland China so much, but talking about Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore.
I know, Herman.
As well as mainland China.
The point is, you can prove anything with that area. You can prove any system works.
People don't
notice that they're all Chinese.
They're all Chinese.
All the answer to that is that Chinese are very good at doing things.
that's a very important point.
We touched on a question a moment ago, the question of energy. Now, I know that recently you said, Dr. Mead, that you did not think the world needed a nuclear or a plutonium economy at all. And there seems to be a big debate going on. It's taking a form of a moral debate on the question of energy. whether in fact we need nuclear power, whether we need the plutonium economy, or whether natural energy, solar energy, or something like this can take over fossil fuel.
It depends
before the
on
end
the
of this
time
century.
Scale again, you see. There isn't any argument at the moment that France can put up a very good argument for needing nuclear power, or that Japan can. And if in particular nation states, in terms of their economic needs, or maybe their prestige needs in many cases, insist on spreading the breeder and on a totally new form of use of nuclear power, with plutonium being carted around the world in large amounts, our problem changes from the problem of deterrence, when the Russians and ourselves at least could watch each other while we escalated and escalated and escalated the amount of nuclear weapons that we had. So we've got a new problem now. Now, and the arguments for particular countries right now, which does not include the United States and does not include Brazil, that doesn't need a breeder at all, are quite different. And people, of course, who the commercial companies who want to make a great deal of money out of breeders, because the taxpayers pay for it, and they don't, so of course they can make a lot of money, try to promote nuclear power, and the military, whose business it is to be as bright and innovative as possible and think the worst about everything, they promote new technology, which they should. And it's a question of whether there's going to be enough citizenship power to say we must protect the future.
Let me make two comments there. I agree with almost everything you said, except it's not the commercial people pushing the breeder reactor, it's the nationalists in the various countries. You don't need breeder reactors.
In this country?
No, in this country, and it's a weak push.
But we're selling them.
No, we're not selling breeder reactors anymore.
Right now we're not, but we will if we're not careful.
No, we're the outstanding group against it. We're the big pressure group against it.
Right now.
I myself, when Eisenhower started the Annals of Peace program, I thought that was a mistake. The world, there's plenty of coal in the world. You don't need nuclear reactors. Now, it's true, if you're going to use coal, then you're going to depend upon importation.
Yeah.
Back in the Eisenhower days, I just thought we were going to go for coal. Push coal as hard as you can push it. It's dirty, it's ugly, it's accident prone, people get killed, it gives you pollution, it's better. as the intermediate thing. Eventually you go to solar or geothermal, or something like that. A couple of years ago, I would have told you the barn door is open and you can't stop it. I've sort of changed my mind. To my surprise, the anti-nuclear movement has a much greater strength than I've expected, partly for irrational elements, mm-hmm. but that doesn't change the strength of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would not surprise me completely, that's a careful statement, if we couldn't stop things like the plutonium economy and the beta reactor. And I would think it'd be a very good thing to stop.
That's what I hope, that we can stop it.
One of the other problems with the plutonium economy is if you count in all the amount of the salaries of all the policemen who have to be maintained to protect the sources from terrorism, you end up with a kind of society that begins to be like a modern airport, and so that you get this polarization of a supermanaged society and unmanageable terrorists.
I think you...
And you never factor in the cost of all those salaries in terms of net energy theory.
The safeguarding costs are not that big. In the sense of people look at it.
But the moral hazards are very great.
The moral hazards are great, and furthermore, they may not bother safeguarding. Not because it's too expensive, but because it's bureaucracy, and they don't want the extra 500 guards and this kind of stuff. And more important, you don't trust the government. It's not just the terrorists you don't trust, it's the government you don't trust. You see, the issue of terrorism may be terribly important. You may end up with a semi-police state because of terrorist problems. But it isn't the nuclear specifically that creates that terrorist problem.
No.
It's a very general problem. I think the United States made a very bad choice back with the Annals of Peace program. We're trying to reverse it today.
Is it reversible?
If you asked me 2 years ago, I would have told you absolutely not. I'm not sure today.
Well, what about some of the other problems that people are worrying about today? There's a lot of concern among scientists, for example, about the research that's being done into recombining the DNA molecule, genetic engineering.
Genetic engineering, I think, is a pure red herring. There's a possibility of doing any genetic engineering that would matter is very low. But we're doing experimentation on genetic engineering that is very dangerous. We're letting people irresponsibly use material for experimentation, which might be very destructive, and people are mixing it up. But most of the time, when you hear people talk about genetic engineering, you know they don't want to talk about pollution, and they don't want to talk about taxation, and they don't want to talk about food. And instead, you have a lovely moral issue about genetic engineering, and they ignore all the things that matter, like what might be happening to the ozone layer now, not 50 years from now.